You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Monday the 23rd of March 2020 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioalbion.com. Well, I'm very pleased to say that today we have a special guest with us, one of the speakers from the Patriotic Alternative Conference last week. Somebody who I've been watching for quite a while, actually. I can remember when she first started putting out videos on YouTube and going on there and dropping hints about going to have a look at Dennis Wise's work. And then I can remember her sort of falling out with Tommy Robinson and then doing a really, really good interview with Mark Cullett on his Patriotic Weekly Review. And of course, I'm talking about Dion Muller, who also goes by the name of Secret Sources Illustrated. Dion, good afternoon to you. How are you doing?
I'm very, very well. Thank you, Sven. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's an absolute honour to be invited to your radio programme. I've listened to it quite a lot. And thanks very much.
Excellent, excellent. Well, yeah, really. I mean, are you still putting out your videos? Because I know that you ended up losing your YouTube channel, didn't you? And then I noticed you were doing more stuff on Twitter. Do you want to just let our listeners know where they can find your work?
Yeah, I did have quite a large YouTube channel, about 30,000 subscribers. But I deleted that channel myself because of all the problems I had with the Tommy Robinson followers after I left that movement. So since then I've had two YouTube channels which have been deleted by YouTube, and I'm now on my fourth YouTube channel, which has I think about 800 subscribers, something like that. I don't upload very much to YouTube at all, because at the end of the day, if I put anything at all edgy on there, I'm going to get banned. So I'm on BitChute. My BitChute name is Secret Sources, and on Twitter it's at Dion D-I-O-N-N-E 4210.
Yeah, I've noticed you do tend to send out quite a few tweets and highlighting things like the Islamic rape gangs and recently this trial of young people over here in Britain that ended with them being found guilty of being members of a terrorist organization, just basically based on chat room transcripts and then talking online. So I know you're on the same wavelength that I am, and you're now more aligned with ethno-nationalism than civic nationalism. Could you sort of let me know, you know, what it was that really sort of changed your mind about that? Because you were quite a big supporter of Tommy Robinson originally, weren't you?
Yeah, it all happened really by accident. I started a YouTube channel because I'm an artist and I draw and paint quite a lot. That's how my YouTube channel started. It then morphed into a channel about a very serious spinal operation I had. And one day I was watching Twitter and I saw a live stream from Tommy Robinson, who I knew who he was at the time, but I'd never really taken any interest in him. It was when he got arrested in Leeds. I was watching that live stream and I saw him get arrested for breaching the peace. And I'm an ex-police officer owner, and I could see that he hadn't breached the peace. So I kind of went onto YouTube and I had a rant which lasted about 3 minutes. And that rant went viral. It was absolutely extraordinary. So my little YouTube channel of about 30 people suddenly exploded overnight to 3,000, and then it crawled up to to 30,000 at the end of the day. It was all really by accident because of that live stream. I started then to look into what Tommy Robinson was talking about with the grooming gangs. And please bear in mind, you know, I haven't lived in England for 20 years. So this has all come to light whilst I haven't lived in the UK. But whilst looking at the grooming gang problem, I came across the names of Mark Collett and Nick Griffin, who were the first people to highlight the grooming gangs in Keighley in Yorkshire. But I jumped on the Tommy Robinson train and supported him and what he was doing. I thought what he was doing was good and right. And to some extent, I still think what he did to highlight the grooming gangs was good and right. But whilst all this was going on, I was uploading and researching. I was uploading videos about the research I was doing into World War II, about things like the Fabian Society and all of that. And of course, that only leads one way. It only leads down one path. And I won't be mentioning anything edgy, Sven, on your radio show. But everybody who listens to this knows that it all ends at the same door. And really, what happened was I was invited to speak at a Tommy Robinson event outside the Old Bailey in 2018. Where I stood on a stage and I was talking really about the police force in the UK and the changes that I could see from my time in the force to now, and really kind of telling them off. And that all went very well, and I got home to Denmark and I watched an upload of my speech and was absolutely blown away by the fact that I was standing in front of an enormous screen with the word shalom on it. And because of all the research I'd been doing into the different societies like the Fabian Society and looking at the protocols of the Elders of Zion and the clergy plan and all of that, and also World War II and what might or might not have happened in World War II, that's where the penny dropped for me. That's where this red pill I had in my throat for so long finally was swallowed. And it really blew my world apart. I'd also been looking into the documentary, quite a famous one called Europa, The Last Battle. And this was whilst I was still supporting Tommy Robinson. I got together a group of my subscribers from YouTube, and we decided to fact check this documentary, which is a 10-part documentary. And so I got 20 people on it and myself, and we spent 3 or 4 months fact checking that documentary and found that 76% of that documentary is verifiably true. You know, all of that kind of rolled together, I couldn't go anywhere else other than knock on Mark Collett's door, so to speak, and ask for help, because it blew my world view apart, all of it. And I needed help to understand, I think, my feelings towards what I had uncovered, because I think that I had been so conditioned from childhood, you know, what you learn in school about the war and the media, the way they push things down your throat about race and British identity or European identity, and how that is being eroded. And I needed help to come to terms with the fact that it really is okay to stand in this position. It really is okay for me to say, look, I am a white woman. I have children and a family whom I love over everything in the world, and I need to protect these people. I need to know that when I'm not here anymore, that they're going to be okay. And that sounds all very kind of like sugar-coated and silly maybe to some, but I needed that reassurance from Mark, not him personally, but from the group, to say it's okay to have these thoughts. And since joining Mark and Laura Towler and everybody else in the ethno-nationalist movement, I have been assured that it's okay to think like this. There is nothing wrong with wanting to protect white people, to protect my race, my children, and their future. There's nothing wrong with that. So I'm sorry I went on a bit there, Sven.
No, that's fine. I was just going to say it's absolutely essential that people think like that. Nobody else is going to think like that for us. We have to think like that. We have to put our own needs ahead of everything else. The same as the individual does. The individual has to put, you know, he has to put a roof over his head. He has to put food on the plate for his family. He has to go out and do things for himself. Nobody else is going to do it for us. And it's exactly the same with the nation. It's exactly the same with the race. And, you know, I think Tommy's done very well at exposing the grooming gangs. And I know a lot of people see him as a gatekeeper, but part of me sees him as a gateway. I mean, because that was where you first came to, it was Tommy Robinson. And through investigating what you saw as a miscarriage of justice, him being accused of breaching the peace when he quite clearly wasn't doing that, that led you to where you are now through following the truth. And if it hadn't have been for Tommy Robinson, you may not have arrived at where you are now. So I do still see him as something positive for us, even though he, you know, he absolutely hates us. And I'm sure you must have got a lot of stick from his followers for doing that. But at the same time, I should imagine quite a few also didn't like the way that you were being attacked by them and continued to support you. Did you get a lot of attacks from his followers when you started to talk about some of these taboo subjects to do with race and World War II?
Yeah, the last attack I got was last night, actually, from some Tommy Robinson supporter who sent me a message on Telegram saying that he was going to poison my horses, and then proceeded to send me a GIF of a decapitated horse head, and that was as late as last night. So, you know, these small attacks have been going on for since I left the Tommy crowd, really. And that's quite, I don't know. I find these things quite serious, because I think to myself, you know, somebody is sitting at home behind a keyboard and have so much hate for me personally that they would do that. And I've experienced all sorts of things. I've had emails from people telling me how absolutely evil and venomous I am. It just goes on and on and on. And this is from a group of people, the Tommy Robinson supporters, who say that they support women and want to protect women, but yet their followers are attacking me left, right, and center. It's just, it's loose threats, but I take them quite seriously. I reported this guy to the Met police. I did it publicly on Twitter. He was removed from that Telegram chat group. And so he should be, because you don't do that to people, whether you disagree with their politics or not. You cross a line when you start threatening people's pets and property, children. You know, that crosses the line for me, and so I try to stamp it out as soon as I can.
Usually, I mean, when it's coming from people towards us, I mean, normally the police just ignore that. And they make out that it's, you know, it's nationalists or white nationalists that are making these death threats, and it really isn't. I mean, all we're doing is following the truth and trying to expose the truth And it takes quite a lot of courage to actually face up to the truth when you discover it. A lot of people would rather pretend that it doesn't exist. They'd rather talk about something different, pretend that that's not really going on, hope that it's not really going to personally affect them. And you've been very courageous in, you know, in standing up to all of that from the Tommy crowd and saying, well, hang on a minute. There are other things that are going on here. It's not just Muslims that are causing problems for us. How did the Muslims get into our country in the first place? Who was it that was advocating for them? What happened at the end of the war when the EU was started? What happened with the United Nations and this human rights idea and all of that sort of thing? I mean, you can trace it all back to 70 years ago. Basically, the problems that we have today, you can trace back to 70 years ago. And for Britain, we'll go back 70 years, but they won't go back any further. Tommy Robinson won't even go anywhere near that. But really, if you want to understand what's happening in Britain and in Europe, you really have to look back right the way back over the last century and see what happened at the end of that war. It's essential to it.
I absolutely agree with you. Absolutely 100%. And I've been putting out content as far back as the end of World War One and the Treaty of Versailles, because that, in my mind, was one of the triggers to World War One. There are many things that culminated to start World War Two, and the Treaty of Versailles was one of them. And, you know, I find it very, not amusing, well, kind of in a way, that when I get into a debate on Twitter or Telegram with somebody about why these things are happening today, and I point them back to events that happened in World War One and early in World War Two, they laugh at me and say, you know, why do you always keep bringing up history? It has nothing to do with this. You're stupid and you're this, that and the other. And I just shake my head and think, well, how ignorant can you be not to want to know what the cause of this current problem that you are complaining about, how that happened? Because if you don't know the symptoms of the problem, you can never cure it. And these people, all they want to do day in, day out, is to point at the Muslims in the United Kingdom and say, it's your fault. When actually, that's not true. The Muslim population and the Muslim problem, let's say, in the United Kingdom is just one symptom of the cause. And there are many, many other symptoms. But we know what the cause is. I'm not going to say it here, but we know where it goes back to. Or if you are or call yourself an ethno-nationalist, you should know that by now. Even I know that, and I'm not particularly clever or smart, but even I know that. So, I just shake my head at their ignorance to these things, because you know you have really got to delve back into history to find out what it is or who it is that causes these problems today in 2020 in the UK and Europe.
Well, I think you can look at the war and you can say, well, we're told that we won the war. How can we say that we won the war when 20% of the people in Britain have been replaced by foreigners? And we were told, oh, if we didn't fight this war, we'd all be speaking German. And people are speaking Urdu and Pashtun and Congolese and Pakistani and all these different languages that we hear. And we're obviously being colonized. But, you know, I would look at the Muslims and I would say, well, Muslims are Muslims. We've always known what they're like. We know what their culture is like. They're just doing what they do. They're just doing what is accepted. Who is really at fault is ourselves for allowing that to happen. And we can bring in other groups that we allowed into our country, that we emancipated and allowed them to have a say in our laws. But essentially, it was us that allowed that to happen. You know, I tend to think that the blame for all of this lies really with ourselves. And the only thing we can do about that is to change ourselves, change the way that we look at things and try to set a good example, and particularly by doing what's best by our people, particularly in times like we're living in today, where we've got this coronavirus problem, we've got lots of lots of elderly white folks that really do need a lot of help. And just the white community, I can see pulling together in the multicultural areas. We've got all sorts of problems. We've got price gouging. We've got people taking up all the toilet rolls so that people can't get hold of it. But in the white areas, that is not happening at all. But white people are pulling together. So, you know, this is one of those times where we can actually set that good example. And I know that when you were talking in your speech recently at the Patriotic Alternative Conference, you were talking about some of the more distasteful aspects of the Islamic society and how that affected you in thinking of the way that it was affecting our society more so than feeling sorry for them. And, you know, and that's the right attitude to have, because, as I say, they are just doing what they normally do. And we did know what they normally did, and yet our leaders still allowed them to come into our countries. Did that really, you know, you said that was the thing that most really sort of affected you during your time while you were a police officer. Did you see more than that problems with Islam at the time, or did that not really come about? You didn't really realize that until looking into the Tommy Robinson thing. Did you have any idea that there was a problem with Islam during your time in the police force?
Well, I worked in an area of Leicester called the Melton Road, Belgrave Road area, and that has always been populated by Muslims, Sikhs, Hindus, Afro-Caribbean, just the whole lot in this area of Leicester. So that was my patch. That's where I patrolled. That's where I worked for 10 years. And I think when you are in it, I'm a Leicester girl. I was born and bred in Leicester. I've grown up in this multicultural society that has been in Leicester for very, very many years. As a young person, as a teenager, you don't see it. Going up into my 20s, joining the police, working in that environment, you don't see it. You are patrolling the Diwali festivals. You've got a place on the Moulton Road called the Golden Mile, which is literally a mile of shops either side of a busy main road that sell jewellery, Asian food, saris, you know, that kind of place, and it goes on forever. It's a mile long. You get used to it, you get conditioned into working in and around these people all the time. Excuse me. And you don't see it, and I don't think that I actually saw it until I stepped away from it. You mentioned the coronavirus and these, you know, how in the UK right now we can see that the diverse areas of the UK are being plagued by price gouging and people fighting over toilet rolls in supermarkets. Well, I live in a 99% white area in Denmark, and I can tell you that our little supermarket in my little town is just normal. There's no fighting. Everything is stocked. Everything you can, I can get anything, toilet roll and beans and God knows what else. There's no problem. Going to a store, a larger town with my husband the other day to buy something, and everything is just normal. You wouldn't even know the coronavirus is here, because people are not acting like savages. They're not hoarding, food. And that's a cultural thing. We're helping each other. An understanding that, look, you know, I'm going to the supermarket, I'm going to buy my usual one packet of toilet paper and four pints of milk or whatever it is, and then I'm going to do it as normal. I'm not going to buy 24 packets of toilet paper and 85 cartons of milk, because then there isn't enough for everybody else. And that's the way that we think. And I truly believe that. I can see the difference just by living here and looking at what I'm seeing on social media about what is happening in the diverse areas of the United Kingdom. And the difference is black and white. I'm sorry, pun not intended, but okay, maybe it fits. It is black and white. It's incredible to watch. It really is.
Yeah, there's been looting, there's been stores that have been broken into, windows smashed, people running in, loading up with alcohol. I've seen that happening in London. Over in America, there's been blacks just walking into stores and loading up bags from the shelves and then walking out again. But the area that I live in, that's 99.9% white as well. And again, everything is still there on the shelves. Nobody is hoarding. Nobody's taking, you know, the last whatever it is on the shelf or any behavior like that. Have you seen similar things happening in Denmark? Have you heard of there being price gouging or thefts? Or also over here, we've had in the multicultural areas, we've got people that are knocking on the elderly's doors and then conning them, offering to get them stuff and ripping them off, basically. That's another thing that's happening here. People are picking on the elderly. Is that sort of thing happening in the multicultural areas in Denmark, do you know?
Yes, I saw a report from Copenhagen just this morning that some warehouse has been broken into and all of the sanitizer has been stolen. And that's in the capital city, Copenhagen. But here, in my area, in my little part of Denmark, it's just, you know, it's a very rural area. There are only farmers down here where I live, really. And, you wouldn't even know Corona existed here. You know, everything's just the same. There are, at the moment, 1,450 cases of coronavirus in Denmark. There's been 24 people that have died from it and one person recovered from it, as far as I can see. So it is hitting us. But we're only a very, very small society. So that's quite a large number for such a little country.
Yeah. It is a small country, but it's got a great history. There's a book, it's called The Book of the Danes. I don't know if you're aware of it, written by someone called Saxo Grammaticus in the 10th century with the history of the Danes in it. And, you know, they were quite a big tribe at one time. And to have this history written, it's a fantastic book, actually. I recommend it to all our listeners to read this book. Do you know much about the Danish history? Is your husband Danish? Is that why you're there?
Yeah, my husband's a Dane. But I'm actually more Danish than he is. We both just had our DNA thing, you know, that 24andMe, whatever it's called.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm actually DNA-wise more Scandinavian than he is. That was quite funny. My mother was Danish, and I have a very old Danish family that stretches back very, 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 very many hundreds of years. In Denmark. I do know quite a lot of the history of Denmark. I feel very, very lucky to live here. You know, I look out and see where I live. It's a beautiful country, and I want it to remain this beautiful for my children. But in the bigger cities in Denmark, the diversity is growing. It has to be stopped. There are some activist groups here in Denmark, but they don't gain a lot of traction. I think the biggest one in Denmark is a person called Rasmus Paludan. He's a lawyer. But he really is only counter jihad. He has some connections with a certain Middle Eastern country. So he's not really our guy. But he, like Tommy Robinson, is doing quite a lot to alert the Danes to the dangers of Islam in Denmark, which can only be a good thing. So I'll give him that. But he goes a little bit too far. He burns the Quran in ghetto areas in the capital city. He kicks the Quran around like a football, and he has a 24-hour police guard at his house and wherever he goes, you know, so he's a very controversial figure here in Denmark. You either like him or you don't, I think, but I think he is doing, like I said, good work to point to the dangers of diversity in Denmark.
So he's just Muslim baiting, really. I mean, just trying to provoke them into a reaction so he can say, look, we have free speech laws. If I was to do this with the Bible, it wouldn't be a problem. But because I've done this with the Quran, the Muslims are going to try and set fire to the city in response to it. I guess that's his angle. But I can see a lot of people just thinking, you know, why try to provoke a response like that? Why try to upset them? What is the point? But at the same time, you know, he is popular. He does get a lot of support. And in England, I mean, I think we've got a lot of Danish blood in England and a lot of words that are very similar to Danish words. And you look back at the Dane law and the invasion of the Vikings and a lot of the country ended up being colonized by them. So I think the British share a lot with the Danes. We're probably definitely closer to the Danes than we are to the French anyway. Well, it's been really good talking to you today, Dion, and I'm really pleased that you've continued in the trajectory that you have and that you've stuck to the truth. You have had the courage to do that, and I hope you gain more followers and you continue to make your videos letting everybody know about the things that you've discovered. It's a very important thing that you're doing. And thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you, hopefully with Jason Coney and No White Guilt. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.